Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling what is, it's got to be the single most consequential decision any entrepreneur faces. That is securing financial capital. It's the accelerant, that lifeblood that turns a great idea into an actual scalable reality.
And if you get that strategy wrong from the start, it almost doesn't matter how brilliant the idea is.
That's the scary part.
That's where we have to start, because modern financing is this huge, vast spectrum, and I think the biggest mistake people make is viewing it as just, a hunt for cash.
Just get the money.
But this deep dive is about recognizing that every single dollar comes with a price tag attached. And that price is paid in ownership, in control, in risk, or in your capacity to just pay it back.
So our mission today is to give you, the listener, a real framework, something that moves beyond just a list of pros and cons. We want to structure your understanding of these different mechanisms so you can align your funding choices with your actual vision. We're not just summarizing, we are analyzing the real-world implications.
I'm gonna set it better.
Okay, let's unpack this. So, for so many founders, the journey begins right where they stand, with their own grit, their own finances.
Yeah.
We're talking about bootstrapping, the absolute core of self-reliance. It means launching a company with personal savings, maybe a home equity line, and then just relying completely on revenue from those first sales.
The name itself, pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps, it really evokes that rugged individualism. And for a founder who is obsessed, truly obsessed with total control, it offers the ultimate prize.
100% equity.
100% equity retention. You set the course. You answer to absolutely no one. And that scarcity of cash forces this incredible discipline. Bootstrap companies often hit profitability way faster because they have no other choice.
But I'm looking at the data here on companies that need to scale. And it seems like that total control comes with a huge hidden cost.
Which
is time. If you're bootstrapping in a really competitive space, doesn't that just automatically limit your growth speed? You're basically handing market share to a competitor with deeper pockets.
It absolutely does. That's the critical trade-off. The limitation isn't just about cash, it's about velocity, speed. If a competitor can go out and hire 3 engineering teams while you're still a one-person crew,
your window of opportunity just shrinks.
It shrinks. Fast. And we have to acknowledge the personal price, too. You're often risking your life savings. That puts immense pressure on your personal well-being. It is, without a doubt, the highest level of personal financial risk you can take.
So once that personal well runs dry, the next logical step, that first external ask, is often friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
It's so accessible in the early days because the investment is really based on trust in you, the founder, not on, 3 years of financial projections.
Correct. And the terms are usually much more founder-friendly. These deals are often structured as simple loans or, and this is a key strategic point, as convertible notes.
Okay, break that down, a convertible note.
It's crucial. It's essentially debt that converts into equity at a later funding round. What this does is it lets founders delay putting a hard number, a definitive valuation, on the company when it's still too young to price accurately.
So it kicks the valuation can down the road.
It does. It's a mechanism built entirely on trust, which of course is also the source of its greatest danger.
And that danger, the source material is very clear on this, is the emotional fallout. If the business fails, you can
do irreparable damage to friendships and family relationships that you really value.
Precisely. You must treat this with a professional formality. I don't care if it's your mom or your best friend from college.
Get it in writing.
Every time, every expectation, whether it's a loan or future equity, it needs to be documented in a clear written agreement. Because believe me, the emotional cost of failure here can far, far outweigh the financial one.
That fear, I think, combined with the need for serious growth capital, is what pushes founders toward the next step.
Exchanging ownership for scale.
Exactly. We're now squarely in the world of equity financing, where you're selling a piece of your company.
And the primary distinction here is that you don't have a fixed repayment obligation. You don't have to pay back the principal. The returns for your investors depend entirely on the company's eventual success.
Which makes it perfect for certain industries, right? Like biotech or deep tech, where
you might need millions or even billions before you ever see a dollar of revenue.
It's essential for them.
Okay, so let's look at that first taste of institutional money. Angel investors.
Right. So these are your high net worth individuals. Often they're successful entrepreneurs themselves. They're writing checks, typically in the range of, say, $25,000 to maybe $500,000.
And what do they bring to the table besides the check? What's the strategic value?
It's what people call smart money. They bring patient capital, which is huge, and crucially, their own expertise. They've often been exactly where you are. That practical advice, plus their network.
Introduction.
The introductions can be priceless. They're often the ones who facilitate that essential intro to the next stage of investors. But you have to remember, they are taking on extreme risk, so they're looking for a very significant return.
So if angels get you off the ground, venture capital, or VC,
is what gives you rocket fuel.
That's a good way to put it.
When we talk VCs, we're talking about these big, professionally managed funds ready to inject millions, even tens of millions.
For hypergrowth. So what's the real strategic cost? It's not just dilution, is it?
No, it's not just the equity stake. The true constraint that VCs impose is the timeline.
The timeline?
Yeah, the timeline. VC funds have fixed life cycles, usually about 10 years. This means they are under pressure to return capital to their own investors.
So they need an exit.
They need an exit, an acquisition or an IPO, usually within 5 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this relentless focus on liquidity within that mandated period can force strategic decisions that might not align with the founder's original, say, 20-year vision for the company.
That's fascinating. So it's not just money, it's really a commitment to an accelerated exit strategy. Doesn't that risk distorting the product or the whole mission just to fit their exit window?
It certainly can. They take significant equity and,
importantly, board seats precisely so they can enforce that acceleration. It's the ultimate trade-off. You get unparalleled capital and strategic expertise, but you exchange it for a major reduction in your own autonomy.
Okay, shifting gears a bit to a different equity model. We have what some call the democratization of investment, crowdfunding platforms.
Right. Crowdfunding for equity involves gathering really small contributions from a huge number of individuals. The unique strategic benefit here is market validation.
So a successful campaign is like a giant public focus group saying, we want this.
Exactly. It proves customer interest before the product is even fully built. And those early backers, they often become your most passionate brand ambassadors.
But the challenge is still the amount of capital you can raise. It rarely competes with the VC round, and I've heard the regulatory side can be a headache.
Yes, and there's also the public risk. A failed campaign isn't a quiet no from an investor. It's a very public announcement that maybe the market isn't ready for your idea, which can make future fundraising that much harder.
And then for mature companies, the final boss of equity events is the IPO, the initial public offering.
The IPO provides a massive infusion of capital, and it finally
gives liquidity to all those early investors and employees. They can sell their shares. The cost, though, is immense. You go from a private company to a public one.
Which means quarterly earnings reports, shareholder pressure.
Intense legal and financial compliance, and just this relentless pressure for consistent quarterly performance. Founder control diminishes significantly. You become accountable to the entire public market.
What's fascinating here is, you see the fundamental difference in risk, right? Equity financing means you sacrifice ownership, but you share the long-term risk and reward.
Right. If the company fails, the investor loses their money, but you don't owe them anything.
Exactly. Debt, on the other hand,
preserves your ownership completely, but it creates this constant, time-bound existential threat if your cash flow ever fails.
That moves us perfectly into debt financing.
You borrow funds, you pay them back with interest over time, and you keep 100% ownership. Plus, the interest payments are usually tax deductible.
The control factor is the biggest appeal, no question. However, you're introducing fixed obligations. Payments that must be met whether your business is booming or you're in a slump.
And if you default?
You're looking at potential asset seizures, a ruined credit profile. It's serious.
And what about the operational handcuffs? I'm talking about restrictive covenants. That is a crucial point that founders, I mean, they so often overlook this in the fine print. Lenders will frequently impose these restrictive covenants to protect their investment.
So give me an example. What does that actually look like?
A concrete example might be a covenant that prevents you from taking on any additional debt from another lender, or one that prohibits you from selling major company assets without getting the bank's explicit prior approval. They can seriously restrict your ability to be nimble and pivot.
Okay, so we all know the traditional bank loan. Lower rates if you qualify, but it requires collateral, a ton of paperwork, a long approval process.
Right.
But SBA loans are different, and I think our listeners really need to understand the fine print there.
So with SBA loans, the government is guaranteeing a portion of the loan, which reduces the lender's risk. And because of that, banks can offer much more favorable terms, like lower down payments or longer repayments. is the administrative burden. The application process, because you're dealing with government guarantees and compliance, is notoriously rigorous. It often takes months longer than a conventional bank loan.
Beyond those traditional loans, there are more flexible tools, right, for managing day-to-day cash flow.
A line of credit is fantastic, especially for seasonal businesses. You can access funds as you need them up to a certain limit, and you only pay interest on what you've actually drawn.
And equipment financing seems straightforward.
Very straightforward.
The loan is secured by the asset you're buying. The new machinery is the collateral itself.
But then we get to the debt options that often come from a place of desperation. And we really need
to issue a serious warning about merchant cash advances, MCAs.
A very serious warning. An MCA is when you get a lump sum of cash in exchange for a percentage of your future credit and debit card sales. They are incredibly fast and easy to get, but they're often the most expensive money you can possibly buy. When you actually do the math and convert the fees and the repayment structure into an annualized percentage rate and APR,
what are we talking about?
You can easily see effective interest rates ranging from 40% to over 200% annually.
200%?
It should be reserved for literal emergencies. When a 30-day cash crunch threatens to sink the entire business and you have absolutely no other option available.
Okay, that sets up our analysis of some of the alternative models, the ones that try to blend the advantages of debt and equity. Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's talk about revenue-based financing, or RBF.
RBF is a true hybrid. It's especially effective for businesses with predictable, recurring revenue, like a SaaS company.
How does it work?
An investor gives you capital, and
they get their money back by taking a small percentage, say 2 to 8% of your gross monthly revenues.
Until when?
Until a pre-agreed cap is met, usually something like 1.5 to 2.5 times the original investment. You preserve all your equity, and this is the crucial part. If your revenues dip 1 month, your payment automatically dips with them. It has a flexibility that a traditional loan just doesn't.
And what about a business that has huge corporate clients, but they pay on, 60 or 90-day terms? They need cash now. That's where accounts receivable comes in, right?
That's invoice factoring. You're essentially selling your outstanding invoices to a third party at a discount to get immediate cash.
That's expensive.
It is expensive. You might lose 1% to 5% of the invoice value. But if you have a massive cash gap caused by slow-paying but very reliable customers, it can be a necessary tool to stay liquid.
And finally, the best option if you can get it, non-repayable funds. Government grants and subsidies.
These programs, like the SBIR grants, are amazing because
they're non-dilutive and non-repayable. They're designed to spur innovation, and it's big, but don't confuse free money with easy money.
The cost is the work.
The cost is the administrative burden. The application process is immensely rigorous. It demands incredibly detailed proposals, meticulous financial tracking, and you're often subject to audits.
So we've laid out this whole universe of options. Now let's talk strategy. The sources really emphasize that the best funding approach changes, sometimes drastically, across the business lifecycle.
Absolutely. It's not a one-time decision, it's an evolution. In the early stage, you have no history, no traction, so it's probably friends and family or angels.
Then you hit the growth stage.
And that's where you face that big decision. Do you go for the high-octane capital and external purchases of VC, or do you try something like
RBF that preserves your equity? Then, once you're mature and profitable, you have the muscle to command great bank terms or even think about an IPO.
And that brings us back to the ultimate strategic comparison, which I think we have to try one more time. The true cost of equity versus the cost of debt.
You have to look beyond just the interest rate on a loan. The true cost of equity is the eventual value of the stake you sold. If you give up a 20% stake for $1 million today, and that company sells for $50 million in 5 years, well, you effectively gave up $10 million. That awareness really changes how you think about early stage dilution.
Okay, let's wrap up with some of the common pitfalls our listeners need to avoid. What's the single most frequent failure point that you see in the research?
It's not even close. Underestimating capital requirements. Revenues always materialize slower than you project, and expenses
always exceed your initial budgets.
Always.
The sources universally recommend building a 20 to 30% contingency reserve into every single financial plan. Just assume
you'll need it, because running out of runway is the death knell for a startup.
A related error, I imagine, is unrealistic valuation. A founder falls in love with their idea and thinks it's worth more than the market does.
And it immediately sabotages their fundraising efforts. It damages their credibility. credibility with professional investors. You have to use objective data, look at sales of comparable companies, industry multiples, to set realistic expectations. Passion is great, but data is what gets deals done.
And the final pitfall, choosing the wrong partner, even if the money is right.
This is so important. Entrepreneurs have to conduct due diligence on their investors just as rigorously as the investors are vetting them. Capital from a toxic partner,
someone whose strategy or working style just fundamentally clashes with yours, can create nightmares that far outweigh the benefit of the cash.
Choose alignment over urgency.
If you possibly can, yes.
Always choose alignment.
So we've navigated the entire spectrum today, from the absolute self-sacrifice and total control of bootstrapping, all the way to the structured acceleration of VC and that existential threat of fixed debt.
Yeah.
And we've established that there's no single best option. Success depends entirely on matching the funding mechanism to your strategic stage, your industry, and your own personal appetite for risk.
Capital is just a strategic tool. The best founders, they see financing not as a way to survive, but as the foundation they need to build sustainable long-term value. And please, work with professionals. Get lawyers and accountants to look at these agreements. They're far too complex to navigate on your own.
This brings us to our final provocative thought for you to mull over. We talked about those options of last resort, like merchant cash advances, with those truly startling effective interest rates, sometimes hitting 200% a year.
Mm-hmm.
Considering the immense financial strain that kind of high-cost debt imposes, what combination of business urgency and guaranteed short-term profitability would make pursuing an option like that
preferable to accepting the long-term dilution and the potential loss of strategic control that comes with early-stage equity? So what does this all mean?